Welcome, everyone. Glad so many made it here so early in the morning. I think there is no mic. Can everybody hear me? Okay, I speak loud. If you can't hear me, just make some noise. Interrupt me, please. So yeah, the title of my talk is Beyond Lamp, but first, a few words about me. My name is Daniel. I studied computer science in Karlsruhe back when it was still diploma and not bachelor. And I'm a co-founder. We are two guys. We're called But Friendly. We're doing software development, web application development, and the whole stack that's involved in that. And I like to think of myself as a software craftsman, not just going to the office at 9 in the morning, writing some code, and going at home at 5. And seeing that you are here on a Saturday, maybe you see yourself in a similar way. So as you might have guessed from my shirt, I'm a Python guy. I'm actually one of the organizers of PyCon, which will be this year in Cologne in October. Maybe we'll see us there. But now enough for the advertisement about this talk. So the title is Beyond LAMP. I guess most of you know what LAMP stands for. It's the standard web stack of Linux, Apache, MySQL, PHP. And if you see the title, you might expect a PHP bashing talk. But I have to disappoint you, this is not going to be a PHP bashing talk, although I'm a Python guy. So what is it, actually? Because if you think about it, Linux, Apache, MySQL, PHP, that can be synonymous for the components of our stack. We have an operating system, Linux. We have a web server that can be Apache, Nginx, whatever. We have a relational database, MySQL, Postgres, Microsoft SQL. And you have some code, PHP, Python, Ruby, Java, .NET, whatever. But at some point, this won't do it anymore. At some point, you will have some requirements that you will probably not be able to fulfill with this basic stack, no matter what language or what database or what web server you're using. It's all about scale. It's all about, growing. There's, of course, one aspect you can grow in, that's size. When you have Facebook-style data with billions of users, of course, you won't get away with such a simple stack. But it's not only about size, it's also about features. Some features could be implemented with such a stack, but maybe not in the most efficient way. And there's also something called non-functional requirements. That can be performance of your system. Yes, you can implement it with your standard application, but maybe it's not fast enough, even when you have a big box. Or maybe it's not stable enough. It's too volatile when too many users come in a rush, your site starts crashing. So, although I'm a Python guy, as I said a couple of times, this talk aims to be language agnostic. So the stack you're using, the language you're using, the framework you're using should not matter too much. And I hope there is something for everyone to take away. It's not aimed at the very top-end developers. So if you're like the architect of Facebook or whatever, it's maybe not for you. But if you have a web application and maybe you are struggling with some aspects, this might be interesting. So let's get to the meat of it. The first thing I want to talk about is background tasks. Stuff you could do in a web request, but maybe shouldn't. Because the user can't wait, and the server cannot handle it, the web server cannot handle it when you do it in your request. For example, sending emails. A lot can happen there, and I mean, email is an asynchronous medium anyway, so it doesn't really make sense to make the user wait until you send an email. The same with calling third-party APIs. I mean, basically every website nowadays talks to Twitter or Facebook or whatever, some kind of third-party service, and those APIs and those services can be unreliable. Requests can time out. Maybe you get an error you didn't really consider. And if you do this in your application, it makes the application unstable, it makes the application slow, and very precious resources of your web server are blocked. Another thing is converting media, for example, image uploads or even worse, video uploads. You really don't want to do that in a web request, right? And another thing is updating caches. The user does something, you want to give him a quick reply, but in the background, all different kind of caches get updated. So if you start and you start to Google and say, okay, I want to do this after the request has finished. And in PHP, there's this thing called ignore user abort, where you can keep the process running also, although the connection has closed. Or other people have the idea of just forking a process in the web server. Well, please don't do this. It's just a bad idea for several reasons. You can't really control it. I mean, the user could just, or a malicious user could call the URL several times and it would spawn processes on your web server and you are out of control. And I'm not even sure that actually works really well. But it's really dangerous because a lot of people recommend it. If you look on Stack Overflow, half of the questions have this as an answer, and it's the accepted answer. So don't believe everything you read. So here's a slightly less bad idea. You write a job in your database, in your SQL database, and then you have some worker processes that pull the database for jobs. That takes the load from your web server, it gives your users, gets a quick response, but it still has some issues because it's data. Those jobs are data that's gone immediately after the job is processed, and I think it's a bad idea to use your primary data store for data that's so volatile, that's ephemeral. And the thing you're looking for are queues. The idea is you write a job into a message queue, and you have, again, workers that take jobs from this queue. The difference between using a job queue and writing your own kind of ghetto queue with MySQL is that a lot is taken care of, and you take the load from your database. But it's a good idea, but you still have a lot of work to do, and it's still kind of hard to get it right. You have to think about how you serialize your arguments. Say you have a function that sends email. How do you actually get the subject and the title and everything into, how do you pass it on to your worker? How do you store return values? How do you handle errors? And so on and so on. Still, if you want to go that way, using a basic message queue, you're spoiled for choice. There are many different possibilities. You have SiriusMQ, which is basically a socket on stereo. It's a quite low level. You have RabbitMQ, which is a really complicated message queue where you can do very sophisticated setups, how messages are distributed. You have Redis, which is mostly known as a NoSQL database, but it also has a pub/sub mechanism where you can implement message queues, and you can move to the cloud with Amazon SQS. But as I said, those are quite low level and maybe not your first choice unless you really need it. There's a thing that is slightly higher level, which is meant for jobs. It's Beanstalk D. I hope that's somewhat readable even in the back. So this is a code example in Ruby. You create a new pool. You put a job in it with an argument, hello, and then you have a worker that basically loops and tries to reserve a job, and then it prints out the body of the job, and then the job gets deleted. Pretty straightforward, but yeah, you still have to think a bit about how you put the jobs in and everything. So there are more high level job queues. For example, RQ, it's written in Python. This one's specced in with Redis as a message queue. So this is a job queue which uses a message queue in the background. And it's backed by Redis. But unfortunately, it's Python only. I'm going to show you only. Anyway. So we define a task. The nice thing about Python is it's pseudocode, so everybody can read it. We have our job is to count words on a website. So the counting itself might take some while, but what probably going to take some while is the request itself. So we get the URL, and then we split up the response text and count it. And then what we have to do, so this is the definition of our job. And what you have to do is we create a queue with which comes from RQ, and we give it a connection to our local Redis server. And then if you want to actually execute the job, we just say, okay, I want to enqueue this function with this argument, and then I have a worker which I can run, so I don't have to implement the worker itself. I only have to implement the jobs. I start the worker. It listens for work, and then when it gets a job, it executes it, and it also stores the result in Redis, so you could fetch that. So that's pretty straightforward, pretty simple. A little bit more complex is salary. It's primarily in Python, it's written in Python. And the nice thing about salary is that it supports multiple brokers, so multiple ways of transporting the jobs. You can either use your database, although you shouldn't. You can use Reddit. You can use a more complex message queue like RabbitMQ. And as I said, it's written in Python. It's primarily meant for Python, but it also has clients for Ruby and PHP. So you can use Celery in combination with other languages. It has a lot of features. It claims to be highly available, to be fast with the right setup. It's quite flexible. You can change out lots of parts very easily. You can monitor it really well because you have an event mechanism, so every time a job gets started or aborted or entered into the queue, all of that emits events. You can define workflows where you say, okay, I have this task, and when that's finished, I want to start another task. You can do scheduling, so it's kind of a replacement for cron. And it also supports auto-scaling, that when you have high-low, that it starts more workers. So yeah, it has quite a lot of features. It also has a good integration into several Python frameworks, for example, Django, Pyramid, Pylance, Web2Py, Tornado. And let's see an example. It's similar to what you see from what you've seen with RQ. You have that task. The task itself hasn't really changed. You have an annotation, which you maybe know from Java or also PHP, where you say, okay, this is a task. I want to register this task. And in your application, you just import the function, and then you call it with delay. And that executes it in the background. Of course, there are also alternatives in other languages. For example, in Ruby, there is RESC, which was... Oh, that's wrong. It wasn't developed by Twitter. It was developed by GitHub. So they use it in their backend for all different kind of things. And a lightweight alternative to RESC is Sidekick, which uses threads instead of processes. But yeah, it doesn't really matter. Sidekick is a bit newer. RESC is a bit old, but the API you use is basically the same. So, to sum up, if you have any task that takes longer than maybe a few milliseconds, you probably should not do this in your request. Do this in a message queue. So, what's next? Next is search. Because at some point, your product manager gets the glorious idea, hey, let's add search to our application. And I think, search, how am I going to do this? So you start off with maybe a like query, with an open like query that looks something like this. The problem with this is, foo is actually a bad example. Let's say fish. The databases don't have really linguistic support. So if you search for fish, it won't find fishing or fishes. It has no ranking. It's enough when fish appears once in the document, and it's not really indexed so easily. So those queries scan the whole table and can become quite slow. There's some help if you use a full text index in MySQL. It has support for stop words, so it doesn't find words like the and with maybe. So words which are not really essential. But it's MyESAM only, and most people probably use InnoDB. Postgres has a little bit more support for full-text search. It has stop words, and it also has stemming. So fishes, fishing, and fish would all be mapped to fish, the common stem of the word. So if you're using PostgreSQL, you can maybe get away with a full-text index, but you probably should look for a proper full-text search engine. It's a separate server that is used for indexing and querying full text. There are basically two main contenders. It's Solr and Elasticsearch. Both are written in Java, but you don't really have to write Java when you want to use them. So the only thing you will notice that there's a lot of XML. It's based on Lucene, which is also a Java library, but it's a full-text search library, but that's only a library. Solr and Elasticsearch are servers which actually run and listen on a port. Lucene provides the full support for all different kind of linguistic stuff, like stemming, stop words, whatever, also for different languages. You can do faceted search, so what you see in an online shop where you start searching for something and you say, okay, I want a price below 100 euros and it should have a SATA interface, for example. That's faceted search. We have a search result and break it down further. They both support it. You have result highlighting. If you have a blob of text, you want to see where your result gets found. Both have an HTTP API and both are licensed under Apache 2. But the difference is that Solr is an Apache project, while Elasticsearch is backed by a commercial company. So can be an advantage or disadvantage. Maybe it depends. They're very similar, but yet different. They're quite easy to set up with Solr. There comes an example. You just unzip the directory, then you or the tarball. You go into the example directory and type jar start, whatever. And it runs. But a word of warning, the standard setup of Solr is quite insecure because it listens on all ports. So if you're running a Solr with an example setup, definitely check out what ports it's listening on and if the server is properly firewalled. So what's the difference when they are so similar? Elasticsearch is a bit newer, and maybe the focus is therefore a bit different. Elasticsearch claims to be more scalable. It has better support for real-time updates, but Solr is catching up. They've also done a lot of work, so it really depends. So how do you talk to a full-text search engine? Either directly via HTTP with a client or through integration in your framework. Let's see a quick example for a direct call. So you do an HTTP request and post your document, which is, in this case, has an ID and a title. and then you can run a query. This fetches all documents. In this case, it finds two documents, the one we just added and another one. So pretty straightforward, but you probably don't want to pass all that stuff yourself because someone else has already done that. So you can use... It forgets my slide. That's not nice. The fancy HTML slideshow. So in this case, we are using a Python client again, but it's the same in all other languages. So you have a programmatic interface. You say, okay, that's the endpoint of my search engine, and then I can add the documents directly without writing code. Solr or both come with a nice GUI administrative interface for Solr. So I have all different kind of metrics you will probably be struggling with at some point. And you also have an interface to run query ad hoc if you want to try out something. You see the same URL here as in the example. And you can play with the different parameters. It's nice if you want to try out a query. So that's the rest of the client example. If you want to run a search, you don't have to call the URL. It's, a programmatic API. Should be pretty self-explaining. There are Solr clients for all languages. That's actually a difference. Solr because it's always, it's more widespread and there are more client implementations. But for Ruby and PHP, there's rSolr and Solarium, which are both as low level as PySolr. And for Elasticsearch, there are also different kinds of libraries. There's PyS, PyElasticsearch. You see the Ruby guys are more creative than the Python guys when it comes to naming their libraries. So there's integrating the search into your web framework, because a client library does not really help you with mapping objects to documents and back. You have to think of that on your own, because you probably want to not just have the text back, but you want to know, okay, which object in my MySQL or relational database is that actually. And it also doesn't handle updates and deletes, because you have to explicitly put everything into the full text engine, and also when it gets modified, you have to update it. When it gets deleted, you have to mark it as deleted. So again, for Django, which is a Python framework, there's Haystack, which has a good integration of Solr or different search backends. It supports Solr and Elasticsearch. So the idea is that you define which fields you want to... So you have an application that has nodes, and you define an index for nodes, and you say, okay, I want to have a text field which I want to index. I have an author and a publication date. And then you can very easily... And it handles the rest of on its own, like updating objects, deciding which objects should be updated, deleting objects, etc. On the same level with Rails, there's Elasticsearch via Tire and Solr via Sunspot. I haven't really found a library that supports different backends, but thinking of it, you probably won't easily change it anyway once you decided for one. I forgot, for PHP, there are also integration, for example, for Symfony. You can have a bundle that supports Solr. There are also low-level client libraries. Next are data stores. Maybe you are waiting it, finally, some buzzwords, NoSQL. Because at some point, a relational database might not fit your requirements anymore. I won't go into details, but there are different kinds of NoSQL data stores, and they all serve different kind of purpose. The simplest one are key-value stores, for example, Redis, where you have a key, and different kinds of values that can be strings, numbers, lists, and they're really simple to query. They don't offer a lot of functionality in terms of querying, but that makes them really, really fast. Often they are in memory, for example, Redis. So you could use them for caching or stuff where you want to take load from your database, even when you use a relational database. You have column-based databases, which are what Google uses for its big table. It's the big table approach. Because the difference to a relational database is that in a relational database you have rows, while in a column database the data is stored in columns, and it's really easy to have a document which has different columns than other entries. And they are used for really, really big data stores. So unless your data is several gigabytes big, you probably can skip that one. Then you have the document stores, which, as the name says, stores documents. The big advantage is that you don't have a schema, so you just put your document into the document store, for example, MongoDB, and when your application changes, you have to add fields. You don't have to do a schema migration. But you still get a lot of sophisticated indexing and querying. You can do full queries. And then another thing is graph databases, where you don't think in columns or documents, but you think in nodes and edges. Nodes and connection between these nodes. This can be used, for example, when you want to do a social network, where you say, okay, I have two people and I want to see connections between these two people. So usually with a MySQL database or a relational database, you would have to do several queries to traverse the connections between those people, and that's quite slow. And those graph databases are optimized for this graph traversal. Another example is users who bought this also bought that. That's a prime example for using a graph database. An open source example here is Neo4j. As I said, I won't go into more details, but it's definitely worth having a look. There's a book I can recommend. It's called 7 Databases in 7 Weeks, which shows the different approaches based on different databases. So then there are errors. Solution is simple. Just don't let errors happen, right? Obviously, that probably will not work. So let's just send an email every time an error happens. Well, maybe that's not a good idea either, because at some point the sysadmin will come to you and say, hey, your application crashes, but maybe it's because our emails are slow, but in fact the emails are slow because your application crashes and all your mailboxes of your developers are overloaded with exceptions. So log your errors properly. You can configure your logging, you should configure your logging, but that's only half of the equation, because then you have a log file. When you have really a bug in the application, it scrolls faster than you can read it. So the thing you're looking for is an event aggregator, which aggregates different kind of exceptions or different kind of events and displays them, so you can use that, so you can easily see what happens, what's really relevant. So you can see the one really important exception among maybe some noise in your logs. So there's Sentry, which started as a pure open source project. It's now also available as a hosted application. It's written in Python, Django. It uses UDP, or it can use UDP to send messages to, so your application doesn't have to wait for a TCP connection to be established. It has a really extensive list of clients. This should actually be in my notes, but well, anyway. You have Python, of course, PHP, Java, Ruby. It has really good support for JavaScript. Node.js, iOS, so Objective-C and C#. So you can basically, every application you have, when it has exceptions, you can lock them into Sentry. And you get a nice web interface. Here's an example from the documents. It groups the different kinds of events. You can have different projects and also different stages, like staging of your project and production. And to get a nice overview what's actually going on. And you can also really dig into every event. And depending on the client, what it sends to Sentry, you can also see exactly what the arguments were, what kind of headers were sent to your application, etc. So, the other option, just quickly go back. That was too quick. That's Arbit. It's also an open source application that's written in Ruby, and the funny thing is it's a different approach from Sentry, because Sentry was first open source and then it became also available as a commercial application. For Arbit, there was first Airbrake, which was a hosted error reporting solution. But then it was acquired and someone wrote Arbit as an open source replacement. So next up is deployment. So when you start out, maybe especially with PHP, because it's so easy to deploy a PHP application, you deploy with FTP. So you just copy stuff to the server or maybe edit a file on the server from time to time. That's generally not a good idea because you want to keep your code under version control. So the next thing is, okay, I just connect to my server via SSH and then I do a git pull and restart the app server and maybe clear some caches and run some schema migrations and maybe edit a file. It's a bit better, but not a lot. What you're really looking for is an automated deployment. You just enter a single command and you can deploy the version of your code, of the code that you want. That command could be fab deploy. Fab stands for Fabric. It's a remote command execution framework. The idea is you define your tasks in a fab file. This again is Python. You define a list of hosts you want to connect to. And you define a deploy task that says, okay, I want to change into directory server my project. Then I want to run git pull and then maybe restart or reload my application by touching a file. And then you run fab deploy and it actually executes it. It logs into the server via SSH and executes that. The big advantage, for example, compared to a bash script where you run those commands with SSH is that it supports parallel execution on multiple servers. It only keeps one connection open, so it's quicker. So for all these commands run in one connection. Of course, this is only the tip of the iceberg. There are a lot of other functions for copying files based on a template, so you can replace variables in the files, and so on. The inspiration for Fabric was actually Capistrano, which is the same thing in Ruby. So this is not in Ruby. You often have more like a DSL approach. So while in Python you have proper code. So here you define a task. It's a different task. This one just searches for files, and you say, "Okay, I want to run this on this host." Then you execute it, and with a cap search lib. So basically the same in Ruby. So the next step is automated deployment with Webistrano, which is a web interface for Capistrano. When you say, okay, I don't want to type in a command, I want to just click a single button, It looks like this. You have different hosts, different projects. You see what deployments when they run, who triggered the user management, and if it succeeded. And for every single deploy, you see the output of the deployment. You can also configure what variables are on which host. The question is whether there is error handling implemented. So it's kind of your duty, because of course the application doesn't, or the task doesn't always know what to do when an error happens. But usually, for example, Fabric, it checks the error code or the exit code of every command it runs, and when it when it's not zero, it exits and cancels the script. So, but then it's your task to clear it up, because that's application specific. So, okay, but it depends on what your task does, right? If you use the okay, great. Thanks. That's it. Just a quick wrap up. Use background tasks for anything that might take a while. If you want to search text, use a proper full text search engine. Maybe have a look at NoSQL, even though if you don't believe the hype. Do proper error logging. Don't get overwhelmed with emails or gigantic log files. And maybe also think about your deployment, if it's really a good idea to FTP that stuff to the server. Well, that's it from my side. And thanks. That layout doesn't look right. That's me. You can find me on Twitter, send me an email, or check out the QuietSparse website. Thanks for your attention. And now it's time for your questions. The question is whether they speak something against using a build system which builds an artifact which you can then deploy to your different services. Nothing speaks against that. Actually, that should probably be a part of your workflow. I didn't cover testing at all. That maybe I should have done that. But it's only one part, because as you said, you have the artifact that gets generated by a build system, but then it still has to be put on the server. So how does it get there? You can also integrate Fabric, for example, in your Jenkins. So when your Jenkins runs, at the end it executes a Fabric task and deploys it to your servers. I think that's still a better approach than writing a bash script that does SSH and whatever, which is really difficult to error handle. And well, I think Bash is not as nice as Ruby or Python. Anything else? Yeah. Yeah. The question is or the common difficult to maintain all these different components. Because on a LAMP stack, you all have that in one place, and then you have search engines and whatnot. That's true. But I don't think there's really a way around it, because what's the other option? Of course, you can try to stretch your LAMP far as possible, but at some point you will have more issues fixing the error's performance issues whatnot with your basic stack. So I mean there are different aspects of maintaining that complex stack. You have to monitor it, so you know when a server crashes, whatever. You probably have different servers, so your LAMP application, whatever, that runs on a shared server maybe, but if you have a full text search engine, you maybe have a separate server for that, so you have to keep them all up and running. So yeah, it gets more complex, but that's the way it is. There isn't really a shortcut there, but of course it's maybe not a good idea to do all of that at the beginning. So when you just start out, maybe you can get away with a much simpler stack, but at some point it will probably grow, or hopefully your application will grow, and then So there's a question here. The question is whether there's a solution for message queues on the LAMP stack. So Beanstalk, for example, has a PHP API. You can look into that, so you can write your tasks there. As I said, Celery has also a PHP client. The thing is, I don't think there is a pure PHP solution. Maybe that's because PHP is not perfectly suited for long-running daemons, but I don't want to get into that argument. I have to do some research and see if you find something. But the thing with Beanstalk D is, while it's written in C, you don't have to really touch the core. You can write your jobs in PHP, and so maybe that's an option. So there was another question over there. So the comment was that when you have a widespread system with different components, that you should really improve the communication between developers and sysadmins, what's called DevOps. There's also an aspect that you can use. I didn't touch that for deployment is using a provisioning system like Chef or Puppet, which actually handles setting up servers, put everything in a defined state, so you don't have to fiddle with configurations. I'll talk about that tomorrow at 2, I think. So there's another question in the back. So the question is how do you handle logging at different levels? So especially when you have third-party software, you want to log a lot of infos, and that can quickly add up. There are different kind of solutions. An interesting approach I've seen in Symfony, it's called the I have forgotten how it's called, but the basic idea is it buffers all the logs, and at the end of the requests, or when an error happens, it logs everything, even the info level. And when nothing happens, it only logs the higher levels, like warning or whatever. So maybe that's an approach. But that doesn't really help you if the logging itself is really expensive. So because that's often the reason why I disable the logging in production. So yeah, I don't really have a solution for that. But generally, I think writing a log is much cheaper than doing a query. But of course, when you have a lot of logs in the end, it gets expensive to deal with all these logs. You have to think about infrastructure to aggregate them, what goes beyond Sentry. So yeah, it depends a bit on the application, yeah. Yeah, there's a question. Well, the question is how big a website gets when it uses such a stack. So, I mean, for some, it's hard to tell. That there can even be a prototype without any users or just a simple server or a single server that it might need, for example, a full text search, and that you might want a proper error logging because it's just easier. Of course, you have more moving parts, but on the other hand, it also gets easier, and some things only get possible with this infrastructure. So it's not really a matter of scale. That's because I said in the beginning, scaling is not only about size, but also about features and non-functional requirements that you have. Well, there's no upper limit. Of course, then when you are whatever Google size or Facebook size, you probably don't get away with basic tools. But for example, those full text search engines, they can scale over several hosts and handle gigabytes of data. For example, I think I've seen a benchmark for that was Solar. That indexes hundreds of gigabytes of data per hour, so you can grow quite large with standard components without having to build your own basic tools. So, yeah. Anything else? More questions? Okay. So, thanks again for your attention and enjoy the rest of the conference.